The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everybody. Welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco, and this is episode 459, dated Friday, April 3rd, 2026. Before we continue, let me introduce our good friend, colleague, and co-host for this particular show, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how are you?
Can you all hear me?
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. All right, cool. Thank you and welcome, everybody. I am in Coos Bay, Oregon, as you all know, and it is beautiful here. It's supposed to get to 70 degrees, which for us this time of year is kind of warm. We'll take it. It's going to be a beautiful Easter weekend here.
We have a beautiful spring day in progress. It started out raw, but it turned out nice. Temperatures in the 50s and 60s this afternoon with some sunshine. A preview of things to come, hopefully. Before we continue, allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer. Thank you for what you do. Our media sources, thank you for airing us when you do. It's much appreciated. Peter from Canada, thank you for posting our programs on your chat boards. We appreciate that. And finally, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. Thank you for archiving our programs on my website. In order to find them, go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down till you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them, and you will notice most of our archived programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to say hi to Diane, who was our facilitator for today's program, along with Brad, who was our streamer. And because we're streamed live, let me give out my email address. For those people who would like to write us here on In Perspective, we always appreciate hearing from the listeners about how they feel about what we talk about. It's bobbranco93@gmail.com. bobbranco93@gmail.com. We have, I'm hoping he's on the call right now, John Gizzi. He's our scheduled guest for today's program. He is a political columnist with Newsmax. He's been on the show before, several times, in fact. John, are you with us yet? Hello, Mr. Gizzi.
He is not here. Bob, do some yammering, and I will call to see where he is.
Okay. Comes on, one of the things that is on my mind, and I'm hoping that we ask him this question when he gets on the program, from what I understand, wars can only be declared by Congress. And I also learned that the Vietnam War, probably the Iraqi War, Afghanistan, and of course this one that we're witnessing now with Israel and Iran and the United States, from what I recall, and I'm hoping somebody corrects me later on if I'm wrong, is that these particular wars that I just sampled were not declared by Congress. And I always thought that the Constitution required that a war be declared officially by Congress. So when Mr. Gizzi comes on the call, I think that's something that I will ask him, because I think there's a little bit of controversy regarding this issue. What is considered a war and what isn't, and does it have to go through Congress in order to be declared?
So I have some news. Gizzi is on his way, and I'm going to react, Bob, to what your question was, and we'll see what John has to say when he joins us. This, you, of course, are correct. The wars are supposed to be constitutionally declared by Congress, but there is a long history, especially since the Vietnam War, of this not always taking place, and there are a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons, I think, is that Congress has gotten lazy and too caught up in their own controversies and don't have the courage to stand on the record for anything. And so it's easier for them to let the president do his thing and not do what they're supposed to do. Now, there are other issues as well. The presidents don't call it a war, as you said. They call it a skirmish or a violent altercation, or they call it some ridiculous name, but they don't use the W word, and therefore it's not really a war. So pardon my cynicism, but I think that's sort of what's happening here too. President Trump almost never calls it a war except when he does. But you know, I don't see how you can call this anything else but a war.
So, because according to the Constitution, Congress has to declare it. So of course there's a lot of gray areas like you talked about. Yeah. I talked about.
There's
it
John.
Just makes it a little more Mr. Gizzy, welcome.
And
how are
I
you, sir?
You. Very good. I beg your pardon for interrupting. The whole scenario of not declaring war can lead to problems in the sense of international law. During the Vietnam War, even though North Vietnam was a signer of the Geneva Convention, they did not permit Red Cross inspectors to see prison camps. Why? Because the Geneva Convention was designed for war. These were not prisoners of war. They were captured insurgents. And thus, their condition was never determined until the twilight of the war, when people such as Admiral Jeremiah Denton were brought on television, and he blinked out the words in Morse code, torture. And we had a pretty good idea of how our fighting men were being treated. My own guess is that when war is not declared, there are no rules of engagement or rules of war, and this opens up some very scary scenarios. Right now, my prayers are with the pilot who did not escape and is on the ground in Iran right now.
It is a terrible, you know, this whole thing with war is just, I mean, it's hard for us, at least for me as a civilian, to sort of really fully understand, you know, the gravity and the, you know, scariness of it all. But, you know, I don't see how we can not say we're in a war. We can use whatever language we want to use, but it seems to me we're in a war. John, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to talk about foreign affairs, obviously, for two reasons. One, we're in a war, but you've recently done two recent travels that I find fascinating. First, you went to Chile to talk about what's going on in that part of the world, and then you went to Japan, which, as I understand, has some connection with what's going on in Iraq. So talk about which one you want to talk about first.
Well, let's talk about Japan. I was there a week ago. I was there for an entire week. I was chosen as visiting scholar for the Foreign Press Center of Japan. And this is something they'll do for journalists or educators. And it's a whole week of meeting government officials as well as people in the Fourth Estate, not to mention some sightseeing that's there, and discussions, briefings from the ministries of defense and war. Simply put, and this is something I never imagined when I went to Japan, Japan is very open right now and indeed may be engaged as the back channel or conduit for the United States to Iran. Japan, Iran, why? First, Japan has always recognized Iran. They've had diplomatic relations and exchanged ambassadors for 48 years. The current Iranian foreign minister is a former Iranian ambassador to Japan. He and his wife knew many of the current cabinet members and their spouses. So there is a connection there. Prime Minister Takaichi could pick up the phone and call the president of Iran right now, and the foreign minister, Mr. Motegi, could call the foreign minister of Iran. This is assuming communications permits that, and make any back channel offers the United States wishes to make or Iran wishes to make. They can be the negotiator, the honest broker in the conflict. Whether they are is not known at this point. It should also be pointed out and this was emphasized, Prime Minister Takaichi and President Trump have a very warm relationship. It's not unlike President Reagan and Prime Minister Nakasone in the 1980s. Their terms overlapped each other, who were so fond of one another, they called each other by their first names in public, which is sort of a violation of protocol. George W. Bush and Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi, known for his very flamboyant hair, were very good friends. And in fact, President Bush brought him to Graceland, where he sang Elvis Presley songs aloud. Another thing, the Prime Minister's, former Prime Minister Koizumi's son, Koizumi Jr., they call him, is Minister of Defense. He's had 6 meetings since October with Secretary of War Hegseth. So there is a close relationship, a special relationship, if you will, between Tokyo and Washington, and this could have an impact on what is going on with Iran now.
So when we talked about this earlier, I was sort of surprised because the countries you hear that are sort of mediating or being part of all this are countries in the Middle East. I think it's Kuwait and Egypt, and I'm sure I'm forgetting another one.
Pakistan.
Thank you. Yeah. And they may be doing stuff, but I never heard of Japan, which I find fascinating. Do you have any theories as to why that might be?
Well, I think, obviously the Japanese operate very much in private. They have a relationship with Russia, and all of that is kept on the back burner, pretty much. Some were surprised, and I certainly was surprised, when President Putin warmly and publicly consoled the widow of the slain Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a few years ago. I didn't know that they had such a close relationship, but they do. I think one thing I've noticed about the Japanese, they like it when their guests do the talking, much as I tried to get them to talk because I learned a lot from them on different matters. And that's a reason you do not hear about some of their international connections or how close they might be with the U.S. or Russia or Taipei for that matter. Quite honestly, they're more worried about China coming into Taipei than any problems they may have with Russia.
Well, I would imagine that part of that is that Japan and China and Taiwan have long relationships, and I don't say they're neighbors, but they're in the same part of the world. I guess it's true of Russia too, isn't it?
Yes, very much.
Yeah. So I'm just curious. When the Japanese Prime Minister was over here recently, there was some talk. President Trump, in his inimitable style, made some reference to the surprise attack. And you know about surprise attacks in Japan, don't you? And it caused quite a bit of a stir. How do you think the Japanese reacted to that? You remember, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I brought it up there.
Yeah.
I can tell you this. First of all, there is no political correctness in Japan. Mm-hmm. And everything is on the table with them. They truly do not care about things like that. If I saw anybody irate or upset, they were upset at the newsman who had to bring up a sneak attack and something that really had nothing to do with the meeting of the president and prime minister. Second, a member of the Diet, the Japanese parliament, who is close to the prime minister, said they understand fully that President Trump means no harm. They're very used to his particular sense of humor and what he says, and they understand this. He had a very warm relationship with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The late Prime Minister's family gave him a golf club that belonged to the Prime Minister. They used to play golf together. President Trump would do an imitation of Prime Minister Abe, and guess what? Prime Minister Abe would imitate Trump right back at him. That was their particular humor. So it is not a big deal there at all.
That's interesting that, that the two felt comfortable enough to be able to make fun of each other.
Yes, they certainly did. And, you know, I know, in the case of Prime Minister Takaichi, she may have been surprised certainly by the reference, but it's not anything she'd be offended at because the Japanese take very little offense.
So, before we move on to Latin America, I want to sort of ask what might happen next? You know, it's hard to predict, but when it comes to Japan's role in all this, what do you think might happen?
You know something? I'm going to take what you may think is a coward's way out and say, we'll know about this later. The Japanese do this kind of diplomacy and kind of work as they've done with Taiwan, as they've done with other countries with which they have a relationship, on the side, quietly. They don't advertise things. And as a result, you know, they get things done, and then we read about it in someone's memoirs after, or someone can come out and win a Pulitzer Prize by writing about it. Maybe I will if this happens that way.
Well, and it may happen 3 years from now, right? It might not happen 6 months from now. It might happen 3 years or 5 years from now.
Right.
That's how long it takes some of these historical things to clear for folks to be able to write about it. You've talked about some of the surprises as you visited Japan and were a scholar. Is there anything else that really surprised you about your visit?
Well, one thing I've noticed is, you know, Japan is finally ready to make a move on something Prime Minister Abe wanted to do and, prime ministers in modern history have talked about and tried, including Prime Minister Abe's grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi, back in 1960. The common denominator is that these leaders wanted to amend or abrogate Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. This was the one written by General Douglas MacArthur. And by the way, I toured the general headquarters that were MacArthur at his office, and it just basically renounced war. And for 7 years, Japan did not even have an army. Then they have a self-defense force. And then more recently under Prime Minister Abe, they did not, they reinterpreted the Constitution in Article 9 to say that they could send the defense forces out. They just did not have to protect Japan. And now, the next edition reinterpretation will probably be, permitting them to come to the aid of another country if attacked in their region. Now, President Trump made a suggestion that Japan help in the Straits of Hormuz. And that's another reason Japan might be involved in the Iran-Israeli war, U.S., because 90% of their oil supplies go through the Straits of Hormuz. It's in Japan's interest to get it resolved. Can they send ships and troops there? No. The Constitution forbids it. But if reinterpreted, it would allow Japanese Navy and its other armed forces to go outside the particular area of Japan and help other allies who might be endangered. This would primarily be a recognition that Taiwan is in danger and needs help from its friends.
And how do you think, if Japan were to get involved in the Strait of Hormuz and get some of their soldiers injured or God forbid, killed. How do you think the Japanese citizens would react to that?
I can't say at this point because as of today, that is not allowed under the Constitution. Prime Minister Takeuchi made that clear in discussions with President Trump. It's going to take a while for another reinterpretation, and amending the Constitution takes 2/3 of the votes in the House of Representatives and the House of Counselors, roughly the equivalent of the House and Senate in the United States, and then an up or down referendum from the people. Right now, the Takaichi government and her party have two-thirds of the lower house, the House of Representatives. They're a minority in the Senate, or rather the House of Counselors, but they have common interests with other parties. If they can get two-thirds in both houses, then they have a referendum where they only need 50%. This is not going to happen right away.
Right.
So most likely the scenario you described won't happen because they won't be permitted to put troops on the ground for a while.
So they really can't do very much to help with Hormuz. I mean, illegally, they just can't do it right now.
No.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about Hormuz a little bit. I do want to go to Latin America, but clearly that's, as I understand it, Iran's major trump card, no pun intended. Yeah. That's what's, you know, that seems to be their primary, you know, ace in the hole, as well as their ability to shoot missiles at all over the area. How do you think that might happen? I mean, that seems to be the major issue here.
What might happen is that a lot of countries are not going to get their oil, and they're going to be furious at the United States for taking the issue this far, to the point where their oil is shut off because they can't go through the Straits of Hormuz. Quite honestly,
not to mention increased prices.
Yes, the increased prices. And I can tell you, in Japan now, one of the things that came up in any discussion of this was our oil reserves will last 254 days when we have to go to them. In other words, a country that has 90% of its oil supplies goes through the Straits of Hormuz will not have to wait long before they dip into their reserves, which won't last even a year. Imagine that situation in other countries, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on their governments, and in turn in the U.S. and Israel, to seek a settlement somehow.
And of course, we don't know what's going on. We hear rumors of negotiations, and of course, everybody denies that they're actually happening. And, you know, it's another example of the fog of war, I suppose. But we really have no idea what's going on. I certainly don't, you know, as far as negotiating is concerned.
No. And again, all of this is done, to use an old expression, through the back channel. It's not something we hear about. We'll read about it when it's finally over.
So let's turn a corner. You also, not too long ago, visited, I think it was Chile.
Yes.
Talk about what that was about and what you learned while you were down there.
I was in Chile for the inauguration of their new president, Jose Antonio Kast. He is very different from the previous president and most of the presidents who are from the center left, or in the case of the outgoing President Boric, the hard left. He's a member of the Catholic conservative organization Opus Dei, a daily communicant, a father of nine, and a law and order pro-market conservative. He said the military coup that took over Chile in 1970 and ran, or 73, I should say, and ran the country for nearly 20 years was very good for Chile in terms of bringing market economics and law and order to the country. I wanted to see him inaugurated because he's just the latest in an entire line of right of center Latin American leaders. Latin America was predominantly a continent that leaned to the left, with many socialists and near communists in power. Not so much anymore. No less than seven countries have right-of-center leaders, ranging from El Salvador's President Bukele, the high priest of law and order, who has a prison that holds 50,000 inmates and who's reversed the crime rate in his country, to the man known as the hero of the hemisphere, the shaggy cavalier, the wild bull of the pampas, Argentina's President Javier Milei. He was easily the most noticed figure at President Kos' inauguration. The first libertarian, and I mean someone grounded in libertarian philosophy and economics, ever to be elected president anywhere. And he's made major reforms in that country to reverse the tide of 80 years of socialism. He was just in the news 2 days ago when he expelled a woman who was working within his own political party because she was also generating articles critical of Milei, and she was a paid Russian agent of Vladimir Putin. Milei is also a strong supporter of Ukraine, and it's in Putin's interest to undercut him. These are just some of the people who are present there in Chile. There'll be elections in Peru next week, and in Colombia later this year, I think at the end of May, and you'll see similar changes, I believe.
And I think Argentina, too. Isn't there elections in Argentina?
Next year.
Next year, and okay.
That will be the report card on President Milei. I can say this. Milei, in his first week of office, fired 70,000 government employees and abolished 11 of 18 cabinet ministries. And guess what? He's been in office 3 years. Each budget has produced a surplus, and they're starting to bring down the country's $450 billion national debt. And guess what? Foreign business is coming back to Argentina.
So I want to, I'm sure you are well aware of the disagreements among many people about, say, Chile, what happened there in the 70s and 80s. A lot of people think that what happened there was lots of torture, lots of assassinate. Well, I'm sorry, what was that?
Nope.
No. Well, I'm only telling you what I've heard. I'm not here to, you know, to get into a whole thing, but I, you know, there are lots of people who just don't agree with that whole assessment about Chile and what went on with them in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And El Salvador, I remember El Salvador in the 80s when President Reagan was in charge. And there were certainly a lot of, I'm not going to say a lot of, I remember a couple of more liberal priests being assassinated.
Right.
It was not a perfect place, to say the least. And one other comment, and I will be curious your reaction. It is, of course, absolutely true that what's been going on in El Salvador, that crime apparently really is been dropped, but at what cost? You know, what I've heard is, you know, sort of major overreaction by law enforcement down there. I'm also sort of reminded in a much lower level what went on in New York City in the 1990s, where Mayor Giuliani was mayor. There was a major problem in crime in New York City, and he did help change it and for the better. But the downside was there are many folks, especially in the African American community, who thought that the police were just given too much power. And so it's one of those, balancing acts, I suppose. But anyway, I'm sort of rambling. Give me your sort of general reaction to what I've said.
Well, let's start. You mentioned Chile and the 1973 military coup. Salvador Allende, 3 years before, was elected as the first open Marxist, self-styled Marxist, to be president anywhere. It was a huge news story, and, he won with a plurality of 37% of the vote. He immediately invited Fidel Castro to come to Cuba, who stayed there a long time. The Cuban military and the Chilean military were working together. He was clearly trying to move it more towards a complete socialist, near communist state, and suppress political opponents. In 1973, General Augusto Pinochet, commandant of the military, staged a military coup, and Allende's last words were, "Allende surrenders to no one," and he killed himself. Was that sad? Maybe. Was Chile saved from possibly going to communist and to Allende maintaining power beyond his term? Absolutely. No one doubts that. There was law and order, and it was a police state from 1973 until the late 1980s. But in the process, the government brought in the Chicago Boys, economists from the University of Chicago, who brought in market economics. Law and order was restored. Relations with the U.S. and the United Kingdom were good. And finally, the military went back to the barracks, and there were free elections. Eduardo Frei, son of a former president, who was a social democrat or Christian democrat, was one of the first presidents elected. And more often than not, there have been left-of-center presidents. It's free again. Were there people killed? Yes, they were. But as President Kos said, there were also people who were trying to overthrow the government who were Allende's protégés. Overall, their estimate, there were less than 2,000 who were killed that time. This is much smaller than in other countries in Latin America with military governments. Were there bad things that happened? Yes. But overall, Chile remains a free country with a good market system. I might add that it was the previous president, Boric, who was trying to upend the constitution passed under Allende or under Pinochet and make it more possible for a socialist government to rule and impose true Marxist-style socialism. The people rejected it and stood by the constitution written by the supposedly evil military strongmen. President Kos stands with them and said that they were better for the country. And had they not been there, I shudder to think what Chile would be like today. Finally.
Well, I'm just going to say for the record that there's lots of people who disagree with that analysis. I'm aware of it. I'm going to let it slide because there are other things I think that are more important. But for those of you who, you know, want to, question this, there are lots of sources. I just don't want to, get into a whole, conversation about this particular topic at this particular time.
Sure.
I do, however, want to talk about what's going on in Cuba, which you may know something about. I know you work in Cuba, but I'm curious to know what your thoughts on the situation and what might happen.
In Cuba right now, something is going to happen, in the sense that Fidel Castro's grandson is talking to U.S. officials right now about a major change in government. It's interesting that the heir to the ideological commitment to communism that began with Fidel Castro, continued with his brother Raul, continues with President Canal and the current government, could be traded away by a very transitional leader named Castro. Most of the current people realize the economy in Cuba is on the edge there, and they've got to do something different. Hence, they are talking to the United States, and this may lead to a change of government. In other words, what happened in Chile through force, something I admit, may come to Cuba through negotiation. Now, I can tell you this. A group of journalists who are cordial to the Cuban ambassador were invited to the embassy for a small cocktail party. I was one of them. And they were just basically asking, do you have any ideas what we could do to curry favor with the United States? Simply put, what do we do to keep our jobs?
And we probably should also say that while the Cuban economy certainly is bad under its own circumstances, we have made it somewhat worse by blockading oil until relatively recently. What went on in Venezuela, deposing the president and bringing on somebody, who is more in our, to more of our liking, has contributed largely to this. You know, we blockaded oil into Cuba. So it's not just the economy, but we sure have a role to play in this. You know, say more about that.
All right. Very simply this. There's a lot of people who, even before Venezuela, before the blockade, were feeling the burden of statist rule in Cuba and a statist economy. And they would look at neighboring countries who are going in the opposite direction and doing well, economically. I mentioned Argentina under the first libertarian president. Well, their economy is booming because it's moving more towards market economics, the free market. And I think many in Cuba, even without the blockade, would have at least started talking to others because people were very upset. They were broke, frankly, couldn't afford food and necessities. If the U.S. gave it a nudge with the blockade, so be it. In the end, you may have an entirely better system in Cuba, a more of a market economic approach, and a better government in the end, and more freedom.
One can only hope. I don't tend to be an expert in Cuban history prior to Castro in the 60s, but my understanding is it was not a very nice place for your average Cuban. Lots of money was being made. Lots of mafia folks down there. There's a reason why Castro, you know, got all this support. One can only hope that we don't go from one end to the other extreme, from one extreme to the other, and we can find a happy middle somewhere. Because
I'm wondering if this is one of the reasons why there was such a defection of Cubans to Florida. That might be a very good reason why that happened.
Well, but the point, yes, of course. But the point is, you know, that what often happens in these situations is that you have one extreme leading to another extreme, another extreme. And, you know, we don't want that. In an ideal world, we want something that we can all live with.
Let me point out, there was indeed a flow of refugees from Cuba, from the business community, the political community, academics. My faculty advisor in college, Dr. Angel Fernandez, was the former Chief Justice of Cuba, and it was Castro who scrapped the judicial system for a Marxist system in which someone could be tried repeatedly, and even if found guilty, the state could continue coup to try them. Very strange system. I'd point out, most of the Cubans that I knew in the United States are the sons or the grandsons or granddaughters of Cuban politicians in the Batista era before Castro. Lincoln Diaz Balart, the late congressman, and his brother Mario Diaz Balart, congressman, and their brother Jose, TV reporter that you've seen on Univision and others. Their father was the majority leader in the Cuban Congress. He was also the brother of Mrs. Fidel Castro. That's right. American congressmen, Republicans, are the nephews of Fidel Castro. He put out a death warrant on the whole family, and they had to flee to the United States. The Juan Batista, you did have a strong autocratic government. There's no question about that. You could also form a labor union. You could have protests there. And you could even have opposition candidates run for office. Batista remained in charge. When he didn't serve as president, he had an underling serve. No, the government was not pleasant. Economy was doing well. Many Americans would go there for vacations, Frank Sinatra among them. John Kennedy, before he was president, went there. And it was
Ernest Hemingway went there, too. He wrote for years. Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
And by the way, Hemingway was a supporter of Castro's. When I met with the ambassador, we were in the Hemingway room.
There you go. There you go. Let's ask for questions, Bob. What do you think?
Sure.
Sounds good to me. You're listening to In Perspective. Our Featured guest is John Gizzi, political columnist with Newsmax. What I'd like to do is ask Diane if there are any hands raised.
Let's see. Yes, we do have at least one. I also want to remind you that there is another stream event coming up on this same stream. So we need to be clear by 59 minutes past the hour. And we have a phone number, 317, right, ending in 317.
Oh, hello, to your guest, Mr. Gizzi. I've spent some time in Latin America, and I tend to agree with you. Would you care to comment, I may be, not be asking this correctly, about the relative stability of the Mexican government in light of, you know, entire regions that are often managed by narco-terrorists?
Oh. I had a former member of the Mexican Congress in my office recently for a visit. She's someone who has a cordial relationship with President Sheinbaum, the current president there. There is no doubt that the gang leaders are stepping up their activity, and murder continues. Mayors and local officials have gone down with guns blazing at them. Mexico is not stable right now, and their government is going to have to take some action to finally put down the gangs that are there or have some kind of a negotiation with them. Colombia did this with the FARC, their version of the gangs, who had mass kidnappings there, including elected officials. And Mexico is going to have to take some step in that direction. Yes, they captured El Cheve, one of the leaders of one of the big gangs and one of the big drug lords of the area. But capturing one is just not going to be enough. They're going to have to do more. I'm not sure what the United States can do to help, but I'm sure there's going to be discussion between Mexico City and Washington.
Thank you so much. Good question.
Thank you. What is your name, ma'am?
Yeah, and what is your name?
My name is Pat Cousin. If there is chance later, I ask you another question relative to...
Okay, before you do that, I'm sorry. What is your name again? You're fading in and out. What is your name?
Pat Cousin.
Okay, and from what
part of... If Pat permits, I'd ask a question totally off subject, but I'll listen now. Thank you.
No. Go ahead. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Sorry. I just...
Well... I love the discussion of Latin America and your knowledge of current events worldwide. I hate to interrupt it, but if I ever had a chance to ask someone who's in the broadcasting media, and I'm not sure I'm going to say this correctly, I'll take a stab at it. What do we need to do to make the very important civil rights issues that disabled and particularly blind people face get the type of national publicity that it deserves in the media? Because
you know
every
what I
other
do?
Cause is covered, and we're not. Thank you.
Ma'am, I would say continue to support programs such as this and stations such as this, because they get your cause before members of Congress and to an audience that may not be your constituency, but would certainly listen when it's on a program such as this. I would also say the old saying that I heard growing up, rate your congressman. It works. And if great numbers of people go to a member of Congress who they feel might be sympathetic to the blind and others, you are going to make an impact on it, I assure you. The one thing you have to do is be patient. Because whatever the cause, government moves slowly, as the founding fathers wanted it to. But eventually, it moves in a good direction. That's why we've lasted 250 years. So listen.
My only comment to that, I agree with you. I think by and large, it's true. What I've noticed is it's much easier to destroy than build. And a lot of us feel that some of the rights that we had that were enshrined are being taken away from us. And that's comparatively easy to do than it is to rebuild them. And so, you know, a lot of us are sort of worried about the direction that we're headed. But, you know, your comment is exactly right.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Well,
Diane.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am, for your participation. Diane, who do we have next?
I'm seeing no other raised hands.
All right. Well, if you see
Okay. Well,
let us interrupt. You
okay.
know about that.
We'll do.
Let's ask, what do you think is going to happen to Hungary? And before you answer that question, for those who aren't maybe as informed, talk about what's been going on in Hungary and what might happen, pretty soon.
For the last 16 years, Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party have been in power. They are pro-United States, but they also have a convivial relationship with Russia because they get a lot of oil that comes from Russia. They've also signed a $1 billion loan agreement with China to build a new subway system. They're counted on as an ally in many areas of the United States, but they also make deals with some not-so-nice people. I might add that they're members of the European Union, but they have, you know, very much declared sovereignty and thwarted some of the plans the EU has advanced that they say are an assault on sovereignty and the individual nation's rights to make their own decisions. This charge is not directed to Hungary only. The Czech Republic and
Poland, I think, too.
Slovakia have been hostile to it. And I would say with elections coming up in Europe in the next few years, you're going to get a lot of other Euroskeptics coming in. Hungary just happens to be the one in the news. What will happen in the election, and I'm going to predict it right here on the program, I've been to Hungary, is the opposition party is united. Peter Magyar is a former member of the Prime Minister's party, and he is leading a new party. Don't ask me to pronounce the Hungarian name. And in all likelihood, he will win. He will probably maintain the same market policies as Prime Minister Orban, but he will differ in the sense he'll move away from Russia and be closer to Ukraine. That's a very big issue because Hungary's taken in nearly a million refugees from Ukraine, and he stands firmly with President Zelensky and against Vladimir Putin. So that'll be significant.
And how might that impact what's going, you know, the, which, and also we should also talk about, since we're talking about the Ukraine war, how might that influence what's going on in Ukraine? And of course, what's going on in Iran also impacts what's going on in Ukraine too, I think, in a number of ways. Do you have any sense of what might happen? You know, it's hard to predict, but what do you think is happening now? What might happen in the future with the whole Ukraine-Russia situation?
Well, my own feeling is that you can never really underestimate people who are passionate about a cause, and remaining a sovereign nation is something that Ukrainians believe in very much. As we speak, I'm planning a trip to Ukraine later this year, and I want to see the people firsthand, maybe be embedded with the military and meet President Zelensky. I also know, you know, that as much as they're drained, they continue to fight, and European countries stand with them firmly. It surprises me that Russia has not been more flexible in their negotiations, because after four going on 5 years, they have not come close to overthrowing the government in Kyiv. I'd say it has to stop at one point, and one side will run out of gas, or its leadership is going to be deposed and a new group will come in. Frankly, I thought a few years ago when there was a march on the Kremlin that was growing in bigger numbers, I thought Putin might be overthrown and a new government would sue for peace in Ukraine. It didn't work out that way.
It's been four years now, right, John?
Go ahead, Bob.
Been four years now since that war began. Am I correct?
Four going on five this year.
Wow.
And I think part of the problem, and maybe I'm have this wrong, is we've sent mixed signals to Ukraine about whether we will or won't support them. You know, sorry, you know, we, and I think that encourages, emboldens Putin to say, well, maybe we can still win this war. And so I wish that personally that we would be more supportive of Ukraine than we currently are. But, you know, we have a president who's, you know, who likes Putin. They have a great relationship. And so it's hard to know how to read that situation.
One more thing I'd add on that is that, Russia has lost nearly 1 million people, or I should say, when you combine deaths and wounded, more than 1 million people have suffered, and it is more than Russia has suffered in terms of casualties in every war since World War II. When you add Afghanistan, when you add the Chechen wars, Russia, their invasion to liberate Osetia from Georgia 20 years ago, they've lost more in this war for Ukraine than they did in all those wars combined. And that includes Vietnam, too.
Amazing, amazing thing. And yet they, you know, war has its way of sort of going on. It's hard to, once the war gets started, it's hard to stop. And that's what I'm afraid will happen in Iran. You know, we've done this and we're trying to put a stop to it. But the longer it goes, the harder it is to stop. And I pray as we are in Easter and all that stuff that we can find a way to get out of this mess, but it's not going to be easy.
No.
John, do you think that Iran has a problem now building nuclear weapons because of what we've done?
Yes, absolutely. And I also think that had it not been for, Israel and then the United States with their strikes last year, Iran would have a nuclear weapon by now. There's no doubt about it. And that set it back tremendously. I doubt Iran is anywhere near a nuclear weapon at this point.
But that's not what some of the intelligence, I guess Israeli intelligence said, right? That's one of the arguments that I heard that they wanted to go to war was because that Iran was too close to getting nuclear weapons, you know, so I don't
know, I agree with all
that stuff.
I agree with that. But it was the Israeli, the 12-day war and the United States strike last summer, last June.
Sure.
That probably has kept Iran from reaching that goal.
So, you've mentioned Taiwan a couple of times. So let's, talk a little about that. Few months there's a threat from that China's going to do something about Taiwan. It hasn't happened yet. What do you think might happen down the road?
Well, the official line from Beijing is that Formosa, which is what they call Taiwan, will be part of the motherland by the centenary. In other words, 2048, the 100th anniversary of China, People's Republic of China, being established. On the other hand, President Xi is in his early 70s right now. He would like to be known as the president who reunited Formosa, Taiwan, with the mainland. So it's likely to come sooner. The Japanese are preparing for that. That's a key reason they want to change their constitution. And, of course, they're always interested in the official line from the White House. Joe Biden, whatever one may think of him, did say on four occasions that the United States would honor the 1978 Taiwan Relations Act, which commits us to defending Taiwan if it's attacked. Japan wants very much to come to the aid of Taiwan if it's attacked. The Philippines, President Marcos has said he would stand with Taiwan if it were attacked. Is all of this enough to repel a Chinese invasion? I don't know. but I would say the odds favor the Chinese doing something well before there's centenary in 2048.
And my understanding that China is not doing well financially, or their population is dropping, they're losing talent. They're not a great situation shape. And so I don't try to be an expert in this, but if they're going to do something, they better do it when they're sort of stronger than they might be, say, 10 or, you know, 5 or 10 years from now.
Exactly. And, my guess would be that President Xi has been firing top naval and army commandants, including the general who oversees troops that are closest to Taiwan, to prepare for doing something sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. I think
we have about another minute or so, I'm afraid. So, what do you foresee happening down the road with all this foreign policy? If you were going to make a dire prediction or a good prediction about it right now, what do you think it would be?
Well, that great philosopher Casey Stengel once said, never make predictions, especially about the future.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen soon because there's so many hot spots that are growing incendiary throughout the world.
That's true. It's complicated.
I would say it's complicated. And what would be best would be some kind of negotiated agreements that take place sooner and end conflicts, not just in Iran, but in Ukraine. I'm not sure what can be done in Taiwan and Cuba, where negotiations appear to be in process.
Okay. Well, let's just get stay operate.
Keep the rhetoric cool. Gizzy's Law.
Exactly.
Gizzy's Law.
Exactly.
I would just add that it is Easter. And Passover, and we should be praying for peace, it seems to me.
Yes.
Absolutely. We should pray for it all the time.
Yeah.
Actually.
Especially now. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for
indeed.
Joining us, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, John. We'll have you back again real soon. It was very informative. Happy Easter and happy Passover to everybody. And thank you, everybody, who helped us out today. We appreciate that. I'm Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings and have a great day.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.